Hello, everybody, and welcome to Lads on Tour. I am Stars of COVID, and with me this evening are Dr. Ivermectin.
Hey.
Brent Lee.
Aloha.
And we are all very excited to be joined by Dr. Susan Oliver from the University of South Wales in Australia. And I'm going to read out what it says about Susan on the website. So her research focuses on developing functional polymeric materials and nanoparticles from both natural and synthetic products for antimicrobial, anti-cancer and advanced materials applications. Obviously, I don't know what very much of that means. However, I do know that the doctors Wolf will know about the nanoparticles anyway. And terribly, I found the drum joke button on this podcasting software, so apologies for that in advance. The University of New South Wales is one of Australia's group of eight universities, which are the most research-intensive universities in Australia. A lot of that is great, but that's not necessarily what brought Susan to our attention. Dr. Oliver also has a YouTube channel called Back to the Science, where she talks about science and misinformation, particularly in the context of COVID recently. Her most recent video that at the time of recording is Logical Fallacies Explained, and she talks about the base rates fallacy and Simpson's paradox. Oh boy. Let's do that again.
No, I'm keeping that in.
Are you keeping that in? Oh no. Her most recent, we shouldn't do these in the morning. Her most recent video is Logical Fallacies Explained, where she talks about the base rate fallacy and Simpson's paradox. And there's a one in the title, so I assume that it's the first of many. Leading our interrogation this morning is Dr. Ivermectin. Producing is Brent Lee, and I guess I'm presenting. Although you may hear from any of the four of us at any time, be on edge. Dr. Megden, your witness.
Yeah, so the theme of the show is, you know, how sort of like an ordinary person can better understand science and what is a good paper and what is a bad paper. So I'll start off with the first sort of topic here, which we want to discuss is what is an impact factor and what does it mean?
Okay, so the impact factor is a measure of the number of citations that a journal has, and they calculate it by looking at the, let me see, it's the total number of citations of all articles in the last 2 years divided by the total number of articles that they've published, and they do it as a yearly rate. So most people want to publish in the highest impact journal that you can get into. So that means that people normally see impact factor as a proxy for quality, because you're not going to publish in a lower impact journal if you can publish in a high impact journal. So generally, the higher the impact factor of the journal, it's believed the better the quality of the research. But it's actually not quite that simple, because whether or not an article gets published also depends on the interest factor. So you could have actually done some really high-quality research, but no one really cares about it. So just because something's in a low-impact journal doesn't necessarily mean it's rubbish. But if it's on a really hot topic that everyone's interested in and it's only gone into a low-impact journal, that means it's probably not the best research. But I don't think you can really say it as a hard and fast rule. There's lots of differences. I mean, even things like a rubbish paper by a really famous author will probably still get into a higher impact journal than a brilliant paper by a PhD student who doesn't have a famous supervisor. So it's a good guide, but it's not perfect.
Thank you. Yeah. We'll move on to our next question, which is about predatory journals. What is it? What do they do? How much do they contact you? And how do you detect one?
Oh, I get emails from them all the time. But I think to explain what a predatory journal is, we probably need to take one step back and look at how journals make money. And because obviously journals want to make a profit, or in some cases, if it's a society journal, they want to cover their costs, but generally they want to make a profit. And there's two ways of making a profit. You can either publish articles for free but charge people a subscription to read the articles, or you can charge people to publish their articles, but everyone can read them for free. They're both legitimate ways of doing a journal, but the problem is if you're charging people to actually publish, in some cases that means the journal is more interested in publishing as many articles as possible and therefore doesn't necessarily care about the quality of them. And so then they can skip the peer review process or do a fairly substandard peer review process. And the predatory journals, if you're in academia, you'll know what they are because you get these emails all the time with incredibly bad grammar inviting you to submit an article for a journal which doesn't often even have a lot to do with your area of research. As for how you know if a journal is a predatory journal or not, if you're not in the field, there's no way to say 100%, but generally if it's not a predatory journal, it'll be indexed in Scopus, which is where all legitimate scientific journals are indexed, and it won't be on a list which is known as Beale's list, which is a list that's been put together of predatory journals. But even if you look at those two things, you will still miss some journals which have slightly dodgy practices. And I think one thing to look for is if the article is in a journal that makes sense for it. So, you know, if someone's done an article about vaccines, for instance, and it's in a journal that has a different subject matter, it's probably a predatory journal, or at least they didn't do very good peer review, because when people do peer review, as well as getting lots of requests to submit papers to dodgy journals, most people also get lots of requests to do peer review. And therefore, you pick and choose what journals you're going to peer review for. So someone who's a really hotshot scientist, if he gets a request to peer review in a fairly low-ranked journal, they're not going to do it. So that means the lower-ranked journals generally aren't going to have as high a quality of peer review. And if it's not in the field that the paper's in, the quality is probably going to be even lower.
Thank you. So I actually have, well, me and Brent actually have a bit of a personal story with a predatory journal. So there's a famous paper which is, well, infamous, which was written in, I think it's the Open Chemical Physics Journal or something like that, which it's got it supposedly details samples which prove that there was thermite used in the Twin Towers, although it totally doesn't prove that. And it was published in a journal which, even if you submitted a random collection of words to it, it would accept it because other people did that. So it was like, it was complete nonsense. But, you know, if somebody, average person, you know, hears it's peer reviewed, in scientific paper, you know, people think, oh, that's really credible. And me and Brent both did.
That legitimizes it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so that was, you've answered the question I was going to ask, actually, which was, you know, even with these predatory journals, surely there's some quality control? And I guess the answer is not necessarily.
Not necessarily. I'd say there's some in some of them, but some of them are just any random letter of words will get accepted.
So I assume even with the journals that charge people to publish, I assume there's a sliding scale quality, whereas some of those are really quite good, and then there are some are hot trash, like the one that Ivor just mentioned.
Absolutely, yeah. You've got things like Scientific Reports, which is part of the Nature Group of Publishers, and that's obviously a very high quality journal. And I think most of the PLOS ones, they're okay as well. But there's a lot that are dodgy. But it is something that a lot of journals are moving towards. Like even now, like I generally only ever submit to journals that I don't have to pay for. Not that I'd be paying myself, but my supervisor doesn't like spending money if he doesn't have to. So
I respect that.
Yes. We always submit to journals where we don't have to pay. But a lot of them still do now have an option where you can still pay and your article will be open access. So even though most of the articles in the journal you need a subscription for, you can pay for yours to be open access. And some people have to do that because their grant funding says that their research has to be open access. So some journals do offer either option and they're normally fine. And with those journals, the journal editor doesn't find out what you want to do till after it's been accepted. So you don't let them know in advance what you're going to do so that it can't influence the process.
That's really difficult, isn't it? Because, like, on one hand, I would like, you know, obviously all the literature to be available free to everybody all the time. That's a brilliant ideal to aim for. But this business model where the person who wants the thing published or the supervisor or whoever, you know, is paying to publish it.
Yes, exactly.
It can be really dangerous.
It can be, and it's also always open to abuse, I think, because of that. And the thing to remember is if you really do want to read something and it's behind a paywall, because you can always read, the abstract's always available, so you can always read the abstract even if the total thing is behind a paywall. But if you actually want a copy, send an email to the corresponding author, they'll send you a copy. So you can't read it at your fingertips. It's not at your fingertips to read. But if you really do want to read it and you don't have access to it yet, just send an email to the corresponding author and they'll happily send you a copy of it. And that's quite acceptable. Even sometimes, I know one of my papers that I recently got published, most of my papers are behind a paywall. But I remember one that I published recently. I talk about this like I publish lots of papers. I don't. But one that I published recently, I was provided with a link that I could share with anyone so that they could read the paper themselves. So someone from the general public wouldn't be able to read it, but I could, you know, send it to my mum or whatever, share it on Facebook if I wanted to, and the journal allowed that to happen. Because at the end of the day, where the journals make their money is with the subscriptions from the universities and stuff. So the reason I have access to most journals, and not all journals, but most, is because of my university access. So the university pays a subscription, and because I'm part of the university, I can read the papers. So, and that's where they make their money. So they really don't care that much if, you know, a member of the general public gets hold of it and they haven't paid a subscription, because that's not really where they're making their money. Like, you'll go there and they'll say, you know, you can pay £48 or whatever it is to read it, but I doubt anyone ever actually pays that. It's just there. They make their money from the subscriptions.
Have you all heard of the get me off your fucking mailing list saga?
No.
Is this Dr. Cortland?
No. So basically it was another sort of similar example with a predatory journal where one academic, he kept getting contacted over and over again by a journal, and then he made a paper fully like in the format of the journal, you know, made on LaTeX and all the rest of it. But he had like, it was just repeated the phrase, get me off your fucking mailing list, over and over again for like 10 pages. It even had graphs which spelt out the phrase and other such things. And it passed the peer review process of this journal. With minor revisions, apparently. So,
I'd love to know what the minor revisions were.
maybe they removed all the swears. So just to get me off the list.
Get me off your mailing list.
Okay, well, I guess we're hitting the explicit button whenever we upload this to the podcast.
Actually, can I just mention one more thing about predatory journals?
Yeah, sure.
Is that even though they're really crappy and have a really bad peer review process, it doesn't mean that they won't necessarily, everything in there is necessarily bad, because some legitimate scientists, particularly new ones, could get like sucked in by the whole thing and actually submit a reasonable paper to a predatory journal. So I guess I was sort of saying, even though you can't necessarily trust something in a predatory journal, it's probably unfair also to think that absolutely everything in a predatory journal is rubbish. There will be some stuff in there that's absolutely fine. It's probably completely non-controversial and no one's going to be sharing it on social media, but it's probably wrong to assume that absolutely everything in a journal is bad, even if it is predatory.
If you've ended up submitting a good paper to a predatory journal, is it possible to submit that paper again to a good journal, say, if...
No, not if it's been published. Once it's published, it's published. If they haven't actually published it yet, you can ask for the paper to be withdrawn, and you can do that with any journal. You know, like, if you can submit to a journal and then usually I think it's if you get back these absolutely terrible comments from reviewers, and some people do this, they keep shopping around journals until they get a paper accepted. Like, they just keep, some dodgy papers will get through because you submit to the first journal, the reviewers will come up with a bunch of completely legitimate issues with the paper. They don't want to fix them. It wrecks the story. They try another journal and they keep doing it each time, probably going slightly lower impact factor until they finally get to a journal where the peer reviewers don't pick up anything of substance. And that makes sense because I know, like, when I get papers back from peer reviewers, like, say, you normally get three, they never ever say the same thing. They always come up with different things they want you to change and sometimes impossible. Like, I remember I had this one paper and one of the peer reviewers said the introduction was too long, I needed to shorten it. The other one said it wasn't long enough and I needed to include all this extra information. So obviously you can't please both reviewers. So I think the thing to remember with the peer review process is it's even if something has been through legitimate peer review, doesn't mean everything's going to necessarily have been picked up because normally, like I said, when you get stuff back from peer reviewers, you virtually never have the same thing said from each reviewer. That being said, I don't submit dodgy papers, so they're not looking for they're not going to pick up some major issue. But you know, you will get them come back asking you, "Oh, you should do this experiment as well." And it's like it's funny because whenever you get back, you go, "Bloody hell!" But then you do the experiment, and you get really good results, and you usually end up happy about it. But that's the way it works. Yeah.
So that allows us to segue into our next topic very conveniently, actually. So what is a retraction and how do you know when a paper has been retracted?
Okay, so a retraction is essentially a paper which after it has been published, someone has realised that the conclusions of the paper aren't actually supported by the information in the paper. Sometimes that will actually come from the paper's authors. They will have done some subsequent research that has made them realise that their original paper was bollocks and so that they'll actually contact the journal and ask them to retract it. What also happens is someone else has maybe tried to repeat the experiments, they found they didn't work, or someone has just actually read the paper and said, you guys, you didn't do this, that doesn't make sense, you know. And for whatever reason, the journal then retracts the paper. And the way you know is there'll be a sign on the journal's website basically saying this paper has been retracted. The problem is if someone has actually got a PDF of the paper before it was retracted, they can share that PDF and if someone doesn't go to the original journal's website, they're not going to know it's been retracted. The other thing worth mentioning too is it's usually a two-step process for when a paper's retracted. So the first step is normally an expression of concern. And there'll be an expression of concern on the paper, but it'll still be available. It normally takes a couple of months for them to do who knows what, but I guess to check whether it really should be retracted and then it's retracted. But anything that's even got an expression of concern, don't go near it, basically.
All right. So what percentage of papers which get like an expression of concern go on to be retracted? Would you know that?
I wouldn't know at all, but just for what I've seen, virtually everyone I've seen ends up getting retracted, but obviously I don't look at every single paper that's been published, so I honestly have no idea what the percentages are.
All right. Well, that's always something to be aware of because it's a common tactic to cite an old version of it before it was to make it appear more credible, like on the internet, wherever. Moving on to our next question. So we've seen a lot of issues with preprints this year and last, definitely. So what is a preprint? What sort of quality control does it go through? And should you be citing them as evidence of anything?
Okay, so a preprint is a paper that hasn't gone through peer review. It's sometimes it will have been written so that it can be submitted to a journal. Sometimes there's not even any intention to submit it to a journal, but they sit on preprint servers. There's a few of them. There's, I think, one called MedRx for a lot of medical stuff, but there's a few of them. As far as quality control, essentially zero. There's none. You can pretty much submit anything. No one will check whether it's legitimate or not. So if it's on a preprint server, there's no guarantee it's had any checks at all. If it's some of the journals have their own preprint servers. So I think there's something called like preprints with the Lancet and stuff like that. That's slightly better than a general preprint server. The reason for that is if it's got to there, it's at least been accepted by an editor to go to the next step of going out to reviewers. So often when you submit a paper to a journal, it doesn't get past the editor. The editor will read it and say no, and reject it. They call it a desk reject. So it just gets rejected straight away without going out to peer review. That doesn't necessarily mean the paper's rubbish. It could just mean the editor's rejected it because it's not within the scope of the journal, or they just don't think it's exciting enough. If it's a high impact journal, like if I could submit a completely legitimate high quality research to Nature, it would be rejected, desk reject, because my research just wouldn't be interesting and exciting enough for a publication like Nature, you know. So it doesn't necessarily mean, I'd love to have some that was though, but it doesn't mean that, like, getting rejected by a journal doesn't necessarily mean the research is rubbish. It could just mean it's outside of the scope of the journal. But at least if something's got to a preprint server from a journal, and Nature's got one as well. I think Nature's is Research Square. I think they where they put all the Nature preprints, but it's not. But a lot of people get confused. Can I? This is a little aside about things that a lot of people get wrong as well. Is Nature, of course, is a high impact, you know, it's a prestigious journal that you'd kill. What would you cut off your right arm? That's my left arm. Cut off your right arm to get into. But the Nature group of publishers has a lot of other journals, which, I mean, they're all legitimate journals, but they're not Nature. Whereas you get a lot of people saying, this paper was published in Nature because it's got the Nature website address, but it wasn't published in Nature. It was published in one of the Nature stable, and it could be like something with an impact factor of 3 or something. So just a bit of an aside, you get a lot of people claiming that papers are published in Nature when in fact it's just one of the many Nature magazines. But I've got us talking about now. We're saying Research Square was the Nature one. So I'm saying, yeah, if it's on one of those servers, at least it means the paper was read by an editor. So it's probably slightly better than something that's just on a general preprint server that doesn't have anyone reading it. But just because it's been read by an editor, it doesn't mean that the paper is definitely legit. They're just going to give it a once over. So they're going to say it's not absolutely crazy rubbish, but it doesn't mean that they've thoroughly looked at it, because, I mean, what an editor's supposed to do is send it out to experts in the field who are able to have a better look and really decide whether what they're saying makes sense or not, whether the experiments they did could have possibly proven what they're claiming that they're proving, that type of thing.
I actually have a story from Research Square. So one of the famous ones from there was Elgazar 2020. Oh. I think, yeah, that one.
Mm. This is the ivermectin one, wasn't it?
Yeah, which was, yeah, it was out and out fraudulent, yeah.
Speaking of infamous papers.
Well, of course, I mean, Wakefield's, well, we have to express upon it anyway. So Wakefield's wank fraud paper made it into the Lancet.
Lancet, yep.
Yeah.
And that's the thing with peer review is it won't necessarily pick up sort of outright fraud. It'll check whether the experiments that you claim you've done, it'll say, are they the right experiments to have done to have got the conclusions you got? But it won't necessarily pick up whether you completely fabricated or the data. It's more just picking up, yes, they're the right type of experiments. Hang on, no, you should have also done this experiment. Go back and do that experiment. But they don't actually know whether you're faking results or not, unless you've got the clever people who did the extra analysis on Elgazar.
Right, so
you were going to tell a story about Elgazar.
Oh, no. I think I will move on to the
I want to hear the story.
Yeah,
yeah, we want to hear the story. Story.
Okay.
Keep this bit in.
It's in my book as well, but how it was found out that it was fraudulent was that medical student, Jack Lawrence, he actually contacted the original authors and he was able to get access to the raw data, but there was a password behind it, in which he just guessed it's 1234.
Nice.
And he was right. And
how does he know my password?
All of the patients were copy-pasted versions of one person. So it was, a load of them were. I can't remember the exact story. So
yeah, there was a pattern, wasn't there? Of like, there was repeating patterns of like 20 or 40 or something, wasn't there?
Yeah,
there was
all
sorts of BS in it.
And there were also things like that. They found people who had died before the study started and all sorts of strange stuff, yeah.
Yeah. I'll say one final thing on this. I often like to just Google the journal, like, go on Wikipedia, because if it's got any stuff about a big list of controversies on there, like Frontiers does, that has like vaccines cause autism, stuff published in the past and AIDS denial and stuff like that. So I like to just Wikipedia it and see if they've got a big list of controversies.
That's a good idea. Or even Googling the journal name and predatory after it, you'll sometimes come up.
Yeah,
and one way of knowing if it's a bad journal is possibly if it has anything by Noren Fenton published in it.
Oh, dear.
We'll get on to that in a bit, Susan.
My mate Norman.
Yeah, BFF.
Yeah, so now we've sort of gone into, like, checking the journal, etc. It's now time to actually do a bit of our own research and read some of it.
Yes, so do your own research.
I always like to read the abstracts and conclusions and just look at the charts and stuff like that, because oftentimes, like it was in one of my debunking videos, Michael Yeadon made this fantastical claim about the paper. I looked at it and then it says like, oh, we're unsure about these conclusions. Like, so I like to read definitely abstracts and conclusions first to get a better idea. I mean, do you do similar when you're like first looking at it? If someone sends you something on social media and says, this paper proves X, Y, Z, what's sort of your process with regards to looking at it, like as a once over?
Yeah, pretty much what you said. I'll start by reading the abstract, and often that's enough to tell you that no, it doesn't say that at all. But often, sometimes I think sometimes you need to look at the methodology, because I think a lot of the time when people are making claims, they don't actually realise how the research was done and what it's actually showing. But yeah, I mean, a key thing is, like I said, the abstract, the conclusion. Is the author saying what they're saying? And if the author isn't saying what they're saying, it's a pretty good guess that no, the paper never said that.
And another like little resource you can do is sometimes the author might be on social media, so you can just ask them directly, because that happened with one of Natalie Edeen's papers. I think it was people using her work to say that pre-symptomatic transmission doesn't exist or something like that. And that's just not what the paper showed at all. So sometimes that can be a good resource for like an average person to get a better grip of it.
Yeah, places like Twitter, the best place is just to reach out to anyone that might know what you're asking. You know, you can do it. I message so many people all the time. Just get on there, send them a message. You'll be surprised at who will answer.
Yeah, Twitter is amazing, like, around that, because it is a weird mixture of, you know, nasty trolls, absolute dum-dums, and, you know, journalists and scientists and everything. That, yeah, Brent, you're quite right. Like, the replies that I've got from people in DMs who, like, why are you replying to me? It's astonishing.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good resource, that is. One thing I like to look at is it super old, sort of like, that's another kind of red flag. Like, if they're talking about a medical issue and all their stuff is from the 80s, that sort of is a red flag to me. Because back when it was one of those, like, notices of liability, which Michael Manuel Chaves was submitting, like, he had for one topic about vaccines, every paper was from the 80s and then nothing since. So it kind of told me that the theory was debunked and then no one ever looked into it again.
Yeah. I mean, another thing just on that is you can actually go back to the papers and look at what papers have cited them, because usually if what they're saying has been disproven, whoever disproved it will have cited their paper. So check the list of citations, and you can often even tell by the title of the citation whether it's still legitimate or not.
This paper is bollocks, Scythe Simpson. Yeah.
Now we'll move on. You hit our methodology a while back, so now we'll get onto some methodological stuff. So the first note I have is sample size. Why is it important?
So I guess the reason why it's important, and we're talking, I guess, specifically about human research, I assume, is that people are really different. And so if you want to see an effect, you need to have quite a large sample to make sure what you're seeing is actually representative of the population and you just don't have a skewed group. I mean, if you look at COVID, for instance, we know that, yeah, most people who get COVID will actually survive, but not everyone. I think before we had any sort of treatments and they didn't know what they were doing, I think that could have been about up to about 5% of people dying, but it started to go down quite quickly once they had a better idea of treating it. And I think it's about 1% now if you're unvaccinated. But that means if you decide to test, I don't know, let's say ivermectin, and you get a sample size of 20 people and you give them all ivermectin and none of them die, you can't say, oh, ivermectin's fantastic, all these people took it and none of them died, because, yep, statistically they probably weren't going to die anyway. So you need to have a large enough group of people in any research to make sure that you're capturing enough people and enough variety of people that you're actually going to see the effect that you're looking for.
Yeah, because with a lot of the ivermectin papers, like ivmeta.com, we've all heard of that thing. Because if you look at it, like there's like a sample, like there's one death in the control group and zero deaths in the ivermectin group. And they'll use that to say ivermectin is 95% effective. Yeah. But when you look at that, the error bar encompasses all range of results. So like it's poisonous and it's a miracle cure at the same time, according to the error bars. And that's... Mm. Yeah, that website is such a quack thing.
my favorite thing about it is if you go to the menu at the top, there's actually, as today has changed slightly, there's a select treatment thing, and there's literally, you know, a couple of dozen, in fact, there's a couple of dozen treatments, and there's a more treatment thing. And if you go into each one of them, almost all of them work, apparently. You know, if this research was legitimate, all you want to do, if you have COVID, is you get your mate to go to the pharmacist, get your mate to say, can I have some drugs, please? Which ones? Yes. And it's all good.
So there's maybe a bit more, maybe sample size is something what general public are a bit more aware of. But one thing I don't think they will be aware of is the two phrases in vitro and in vivo. So what do they mean?
Okay, so in vitro basically is experiments done in cells or cell culture, and they can be either human cells or sometimes animal cells. Now, the first thing to say about in vitro is it gets a lot of flack, but it is absolutely essential research, and it's the only sort of research that I do. I don't go to the next step, which is in vivo, which we'll talk about in a minute. But although in vitro is really important and it gives you a lot of information, it's a mistake to think it's necessarily going to be relevant to anything that happens in the human body. And the reason for that is you can do things with cells that you just can't do with humans. So you just lay all your cells out. It's not that much room, they're tiny, tiny little. But sort of when you've got a cell there, it's sort of like a captured audience almost. You can sort of pour anything you like on it and it's going to absorb it and either die or live depending on what you're trying to do. But when it's a cell that's actually, say, inside an organ, you don't know that your active ingredient is even going to get to that cell in the first place. The other thing a lot of people do, and this is say like cancer research, people all develop various things, and I do this, and you'll test them on a cancer cell and they'll kill the cancer cell. And you think, fantastic. And people literally will publish papers saying this, you know, such and such killed this cancer cell, that's killed this cancer cell. And then, you know, people get and go, wow, this is a cure for cancer. Look, it's killing these cancer cells. But what a lot of people don't do is they don't check whether it also just kills normal cells, because killing cancer cells could just mean you've made something that's toxic to cells. Like, you can kill cancer cells with, you know, bleach, alcohol, pure water. They're really, really easy to kill. So
bleach works in vitriol.
Yes, it's fantastic, fantastic. So I think one of the – and the other thing you can do in vitro is you can use really high doses which aren't achievable in the human body. So there's a lot of things you can do in vitro that you can't do in a human body. And one more thing, and if we go to ivermectin, people got really excited about ivermectin because it was shown to inhibit SARS-CoV-2 in cells. Now, there were two problems with that. One was the concentration used was way too high to be achieved in a human body without killing the person. But the second issue was they actually did it in monkey kidney cells. They're called Vero cells, but they're essentially kidney cells for monkeys. Someone repeated the experiment in human lung cells. Didn't work. So another problem is it's not only can you just use inappropriate doses, you can use inappropriate cells because, you know, bits of the human body are different because they contain different cells. So you need to make sure if you are doing cell work, you're actually using a cell that's actually relevant to what you want. In vivo research is research in animals, essentially. So that's the next step up from in vitro research. And certainly in any Western country, if you want to do experiments in vivo in animals, you have to do in vitro research first, show that you've actually got something viable in vitro, and you actually have to put forward your experiments to an ethics committee that say, yes, it's worthwhile doing that, because you can't just go experimenting on animals just because you've got some crazy idea. There has to be some, you know, there has to be a specific reason to be experimenting on an animal. And typically the when you're doing in vivo research, you normally do use, at least initially, sort of fairly small animals, something like mice, rats, and depending on where you're going, you can sort of work your way up to larger animals, like some research is done in human primates, non-human primates, but that's awfully expensive, so you don't see a lot of it. But the important thing is you can't do any research in humans unless you've already done the in vitro research and the in vivo research. And that's because, you know, you just don't take chances with people. But unfortunately, we also know that just because something works in vivo, it also doesn't mean it's actually going to work in humans. Like, there's a saying, we cured cancer in mice years ago, but we haven't cured it in people because people aren't mice.
There is an old joke, you know, this compound kills cancer cells in a Petri dish. Well, I could do that with a machine gun. Why do I care?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you start with in vitro. Does it work at all? And under, because you can have perfect circumstances or really good circumstances for the what you're trying to achieve in vitro. If that works, you try something in mice, say. If that works, the same thing in bigger mammal, like a pig or something. If that works, you might get the primates. And then if that works, you get to people. And if that works, it goes on the market.
And obviously, when you get to people, you have your phase one, your phase two, and your phase three. And you need to have gone through. So phase one is actually, it's mainly safety testing. So it's actually in phase one, it's actually given to completely healthy people just to make sure it doesn't kill them. Then phase two, you start to look a little bit at efficacy, and then phase three is when you actually do your randomised controlled trials, and you need to have passed phase three before you can then submit an application to go onto the market. And very, very few things that start off successful in vitro research ever make it to market. That being said, very few of them even get that far. Like you know, I said, like, you've got to make things that kill cancer cells but don't kill normal cells. I've I've made heaps. None of them have even got to the next step of in vivo research, and that's because I can't get funding to do it. And that's, and look, that's not a problem that's unique to me. That's the problem of every scientist in the world. And sometimes when you're doing the in vitro research, even if you've got something that does work, you can still think of, hang on, I know how I can make that better. And so you're not necessarily even going to want to always take what you're doing to in vivo research. There's sort of a bit of an iterative process anyway. But a lot of research really doesn't get to the next step because you're always competing for funding and not everyone's going to get it, and that's just a sad fact of life.
That's difficult, isn't it? Because there's every chance that you have, you know, somewhere in your research got something that could be really, really useful for that, but it's...
Yeah, potentially, yeah. We'll never know. But like I say, this is not something that's unique to me. This is, you know, there's lots of other scientists that are in exactly the same boat.
What often I've sort of noted is, I think I might be alone in that, but we'll see. So sort of like oftentimes when a paper is sort of like a bit dodgy, it will just sort of like propose a mechanism for something without necessarily proving it. So that's maybe a bit more high level for a member of the general public to delve into. But what are sort of your comments on that?
Depending on what type of research, that's something that you could actually do, and then in a later paper you could then prove whether it happened or not. So I think as far as saying that in a paper, that's probably fairly legitimate thing to do, to propose a mechanism but not necessarily know for sure whether that mechanism is correct. I think the issue is if members of the general public read that it's sort of missed the word proposed and think, yes, that's the mechanism. I think a lot of the issues with papers is not so much the papers at all. It's actually the interpretation of the papers, because when a scientist writes a paper, they're not necessarily writing it for the general public. They're writing it for other scientists who know, if they see the word proposed mechanism, I know I have papers that actually say proposed mechanism in them, so that's why I'm saying it's really good. But a scientist reading the word proposed mechanism knows that means it's a proposed mechanism. It doesn't actually mean that the mechanism has been proven. So a scientist reading it reads exactly what you've written and understands it, whereas a member of the general public doesn't quite understand what they're reading, and they think they're reading something that they're not reading. And I think that's just a problem with when you write a research paper, your audience is scientists sort of studying, sort of, you know, doing research in the same field as what you are. It's not the general public. It's not even necessarily a scientist from a faraway field. So that's, I think, probably one of the issues. You see that less in something, say, like Nature and Science. So one of the things, if you're publishing a paper in Nature or Science, they're meant to be written to appeal to a more general audience, because it's a general journal. It doesn't have any particular field. It sort of accepts science from all over the place. So if you are submitting a paper there, it's meant to be written so it's more understandable. But even then, it's meant to be written so it's more understandable by a scientific audience, still not by a layman. I think saying this is a proposed mechanism is fine to say in a paper, but the problem is often the people reading it don't necessarily understand what that means.
Yeah, and I think there's also intentional misinformation around it, like they can crop off the bit where it's just proposed.
Yeah.
Or, you know, whatever, you know. Yeah, I think the classic, you know, aluminium penetrates the blood-brain barrier and causes autism from vaccines or whatever, was one of those which you sort of see, oh, it's in this paper, see?
Yeah. So sounds like there's possibly a dodgy paper to start with in that case, yes.
Yeah. So one sort of, well, this is more of an intentional misinformation tactic, is where like the sections oftentimes where you can criticise a paper, like after it's published, oftentimes what someone will do is publish a criticism of it, but they'll say, oh, look, it's peer-reviewed, like their criticism of it. Like there was the classic 83% of vaccinated pregnant women lost their children. Like there was that one where the reality is like 90% of them were still pregnant at the time.
Yes.
So yeah, that's a common tactic. So how do you sort of go about to see if it's actually in the research or whether it's just a criticism of it? Maybe it's quite obvious though.
I guess you just have to go back to the research and read what it says. Like I said, the problem is because I think that claim about the pregnancy, I think that came from one of the supposed releases of all this data that they were trying to hide from you, you know.
For 75 years.
75 years, yeah. And that is also really, those documents are also a classic case of documents that were never meant to be read by people who don't understand what they're reading, because they're documents that were prepared for people who work in regulatory agencies. And the same, and the other crazy thing is people, the supposed hidden documents, they were supplied to every single regulatory agency in the world. Like everyone got the same documents, like, you know, FDA got it, TGA got it in Australia. I don't know what your guys are called, MHRA or something, is that right?
MHRA, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of like this, these documents that they were hiding from a few thousand people who already had them, you know, but that's a case of, yes, if you go back to the documents, it makes it pretty clear that, because I think it says something like, you know, such and such, that there's no outcome data for the pregnancies. And the reason, of course, was, yeah, they were still pregnant. So that's why there was no outcome data. And yeah, that one, I can understand in that case why it was easy for people to spread the misinformation, because when you read the document, if you don't know what you're reading, it literally does sound like, because that was it said, it specifically said something on the lines of, you know, there was no outcome data for whatever percent it was, and it was because they were still pregnant. But people reading it probably don't understand that because they're just not used to reading that type of document, whereas someone from Regulatory Affairs reads it and knows straight away, yeah, of course, you know, because they read those type of documents every day. And that's it. The whole package of Pfizer stuff was prepared for people who specifically analyze those types of documents, not for some crazy anti-vaxxer.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? And like the bad faith arguments sort of like hide in jargon and how things are. So in the Pfizer, it wasn't even jargon, but in one of the Pfizer releases, there was a page of every single thing that they were possibly considering.
Oh, yes.
9 pages, yes.
The nine pages of adverse events, yes.
Yeah, one of them was packaging issues.
Yeah.
Like, you know, obviously, you know, so they're thinking, well, look, whenever we release this, we might be able to get the vials or the boxes or the cartons, whatever they need to put the stuff in. I don't know. I don't manufacture vaccines. But people just saw this big list of stuff, and some of them are pretty scary. So, but it's, I find it very difficult to, now not everybody who shared that, you know, was making a bad faith argument, right? But somebody was going to the bother of reading that document. Well, maybe they didn't read the document, but at least scanning the document, seeing a big list of stuff and not seeing the heading, because it wasn't difficult. It really wasn't. Either not seeing the heading or seeing the heading and not giving a flying care, not caring, and just publishing it anyway, because, or, you know, publishing their scare story anyway. And I don't know which one it is. I don't know if it makes much difference if somebody is too lazy to go back to the heading and they see a scary list, or if they are deliberately telling lies. Like, at that point, the laziness is so extreme, I don't know how much it even matters.
Yeah, I think there's definitely, and I think what happens is the first person publishes, does it and gets it wrong, and then all the people repeating it are basically, they're not really even looking at the document. They're looking at what the first lazy person had said, and then they're repeating it without actually checking themselves. Because I remember when it came out, because I made a video about it, you know, not long after the crazy claims came out, just to say, no, actually, this is what it is. And then I remember John Campbell, after I'd already published mine, obviously he doesn't watch my videos because why would he? I'm a tiny person. But he then published the same scare story as everyone else. And then he finally managed to find out he'd got it wrong, and then published a bit of a supposed apology, but still managed to sort of somehow turn it around and saying, but they never told, you know, instead of, he had to admit that no, the 9 pages weren't actually adverse events that had happened with the vaccine, but then he still tried to make it into bad Pfizer by saying, but they never provided this list to all the doctors, so they didn't know they were supposed to be looking out for all these side effects. Like, seriously? I mean, doctors know that you're supposed to report any side effect. It doesn't have to be on this crazy 9 list. They were looking out for. Yeah, it's like if something else comes up, you're still supposed to report it, not just the things that are on the list, the 9 pages.
Yeah, you used to record videos of Dr. Campbell, right?
I used to watch Dr. Campbell. I used to watch him every single... I used to watch every single video he did, and I thought he was, you know, seemed like a really nice guy and everything. And I was just watching one day, and he was presenting some information from Australia, and he made a mistake. He got it wrong. Nothing malicious. He just didn't quite understand what was going on. So I just sent him a very nice email saying, you know, hi John, really love your channel, blah, blah, blah. Told him, explained to him what the information actually was. And then I also included a photo of me in the lab wearing my pink lab coat and wearing a pink face mask. And I sort of just said something along the lines of, oh, I'm not sure if you're still showing, because he'd been showing pictures of people wearing their face masks. And I said, oh, I'm not sure if you're still showing pictures of people wearing face masks, but if you are, here's one of me. Anyway, next day, his video comes out, suddenly, there I am, pictures of Susan, and he did the apology that he'd got it all wrong and read it all out and sent me an email back saying, you know, thank you for correcting me, I really appreciate it, and said, yes, and yes, I do still accept photos, and I also quite like video updates. So I thought, oh, okay then. So I sent him a video up a few days later when things started happening. So I sent him a video update of what was happening in Australia, just, you know, short 5-minute thing of what was going on. Got quite a good response from his audience. So he sort of, you know, he'd send me over saying, this is really good, the audience loved it, you know, feel free to send more. And so I kept sending him probably about once a week, once every 2 weeks. And I had mentioned in one, for some reason, I'd mentioned the fact that I worked on nanomedicine because it was relevant to the video. I think it was about the vaccine's making you magnetic. And I said it was maybe because you can actually get magnetic nanoparticles, and maybe people were confused because of that. And I mentioned that I worked on nanomedicine. And then anyway, a few people said, oh, we'd really like to know more about nanomedicine. Maybe you should, you know, interview Dr. Susan. And so he'd contact me and said, you know, do you want to do an interview on the nanomedicine? I said, yep, that'd be great. And anyway, we were set up to do the interview, and then things, so it's a bit of a long-winded story, but things exploded in Australia, and we actually had an outbreak in New South Wales, which, because, you know, Australia had sort of managed to stay pretty much COVID-free, particularly in Sydney where I lived. But suddenly, basically, it got into the country and we were suddenly gone into lockdown. And so I'd actually said to him, oh, look, John, it's things are going crazy in Australia, and we decided instead of doing the research on the – instead of doing the interview about nanomedicine, we'd actually do a video about what was happening in Australia. So he interviewed me and we did about a 40-minute video. Anyway, he then said to me, okay, we'll organise next week. He said, but asked me if I'd buy a microphone so that we'd have better sound, because up at that stage I was just using my computer microphone. I said, yep, no worries, and I'll contact you when I get the microphone. So I bought a microphone, and in the meantime, he'd done a report about the test lorry meta-analysis on ivermectin, and then another meta-analysis had come out which said, unsurprisingly, the opposite to what hers did. And so I'd sent him an email about it, you know, just very politely saying, just letting you know, John, that there's also this second one, and explaining why it was actually a better analysis than test lorry. It's all very polite, no reply. Just didn't reply to me. I thought, it's a bit strange. So anyway, I should explain, this is not his general email address that everyone's got. This is an email address that he'd given to me. So it's not like my email had been lost amongst his thousands of emails. Anyway, I also had his WhatsApp number. So a couple of days later, I just sort of sent him a message saying, oh, John, you know, just letting you know, I've got the microphone now. You know, when do you want to schedule the interview? No answer. I tried one more time. No answer. He just basically completely ghosted me. So that's what happened with John Campbell. And prior to that, like I said, he really is, up until he ghosted me, he lovely, lovely guy. And it was just quite bizarre.
And there's been no contact since?
No contact since. But anyway, I was left with this microphone. I thought, what am I going to do? I know, I'll start my own channel.
That's your supervillain origin story, that is, yeah.
There can't be too many people who buy the microphone and then start the channel. That's great.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's the story on John Campbell. So we'll get on to the next topic, and maybe a certain person will come up in this one. The topic of p-hacking. What does it mean? And
That's whenever you let your dog out to pee, right? P-hacking, right? No, yeah. That was a bad joke, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's too perfect.
Yeah, so p-hacking is generally, if you do some research and, I just have to give Cindy a treat now for being a good girl. good girl. Okay, so when you do research, often if you do research and you basically find your research shows absolutely nothing, what some people will do is they'll start analysing the results by different subgroups, and they'll just keep looking at different subgroups until they finally find a subgroup where they actually see some sort of difference. And if you think with, like, normally when you're looking at statistical significance, you're looking at a 95% confidence interval. So there's 1 in 20 chance that you're seeing, that you're not seeing something, you know, that you could.
Yeah, 1 in 20 chance it's just noise.
That's right. So if you actually keep looking at subgroup at subgroup at subgroup, eventually you'll find a subgroup where it looks like it's significant when really it isn't, you know. If you look at 20 different subgroups, you'll finally find one where it looks like you've got a significant difference when really it's just random. And so what people do with p-hacking is they just keep trying different ways of analysing the data until they get something that is statistically significant.
Can you name any recent papers that had a p-hacking in it, Dr. Oliver?
Well, it's funny you should say that, and I don't know if I'd really call it a paper because it was only a preprint, but there was a recent paper by a bunch of people. I can't remember most of their names, but one of the people was Peter Doshi, was one of the co-authors on the paper.
The AIDS denier.
Yes. And I can't think what it was called now, but They basically found this incredibly crazy way of analysing adverse events so that they could show there were more adverse events occurring with the vaccine than what was occurring with placebo. But they did it by defining this crazy subgroup so the subgroup didn't actually include all the adverse events. They came up with this unique list of adverse events that happened to show statistical significance.
Left-handed people called Barry or something.
Yeah, it was pretty similar to that. But even then, to get statistical significance, they had to combine the Pfizer and the Moderna data, which probably upset them a bit because I'm sure Peter Doshi would have preferred it just to have happened with the Pfizer data, but he couldn't get statistical significance that way, so he had to include Moderna. I actually don't know whether that's true. I'm just being a bit naughty saying that. But that was the only way they showed statistical significance, was if they actually combined the Pfizer and the Moderna data.
Yeah, so if you attack Doshi, Norman Fenton will send his annoying fan army after you. It's important to know that.
Well, I know that now. I remember thinking it was so bizarre. Because obviously I'm in a different time zone, so I'd sort of gone to bed at night and I woke up in the morning and I've just got this crazy number of notifications on Twitter and I'm thinking, what's going on?
Yeah,
it was so interesting how Norman Fenton, I guess we'll call him Professor Fenton, he puts scientists in quotes, and it's quite interesting that because you had explained what, so he did like a thread of about five tweets, and what I found fascinating about it was at no point did he actually raise a criticism of the of your response to the preprint. He talked about, you know, other research that you've been involved with. So you've been involved in, let me get this right, research into the female orgasm.
That's right. And the crazy thing is he even got that wrong, because I wasn't involved in it at all. So I just actually shared some information about a clinical trial that was about it. Like, what, I had nothing to do with the research at all.
The jokes write themselves at that point.
Yeah.
But,
yes.
I think I want to know really how you feel about what it's like whenever credentialed people, because honestly, I don't really regard Fenton with any regard at all. I mean, I think a darts player is probably better at maths than he is. So we'll say credentialed people, whenever credentialed people are in a debate about the veracity or about a paper or a preprint or whatever, what should happen and what did happen, and how do we, you know, how should that discussion have happened? Because I imagine that him doing a 5-point tweet thread to have his flying monkeys after you, which didn't involve any criticism of the criticisms you made, wasn't the correct way of going about things. What should have happened?
Well, I think, well, nothing should have happened really, because there was nothing to critique.
Because you were right.
Exactly.
Assuming you had been wrong, what should have happened?
Okay, assuming I had been wrong, I think the correct way to do it is what he kind of ended up doing, which was he did actually put together a blog post which supposedly had proper critiques about my video on it. I, of course, then put out another video explaining why his blog post was incorrect, which he ignored. But I think as an approach, that is the way that you should do it, is you actually, you don't just sort of insult the person. But in some ways, doing that, as soon as I see someone doing stuff like that, you think, okay, they've obviously haven't got a legitimate criticism, because they're just basically insulting me. And that's the majority of comments I get on my YouTube videos as well. It's just people just blatantly insulting me. Like, they say I look creepy. They don't like the fact that I smile. Smiling is bad. And, you know, various other things you get. But when I see criticism like that, it's like, okay, so that person hasn't got anything legitimate to say. So I think the correct way, I think what he finally did was, because a lot of people did actually say to him, well, you haven't actually critiqued anything. And a few days later he said, okay, we'll have a blog post explaining what's wrong with it. And he did put out a blog post which was total rubbish. Like, it sort of, a lot of it was strawman, like a bit like next, another fallacy. Actually, I'm going to use it for my strawman fallacy video, I think. But a lot of what he was saying was a strawman saying, oh, you know, she said this. It's like, no, I never actually said that. And, you know, it's not p-hacking because they didn't actually use p-values. And it's like, well, the concept of p-hacking, you don't actually have to use the p-values. They were showing statistical significance. They had confidence intervals. So, you know, he was just coming up with all these ridiculous, spurious arguments. But at least that is the correct approach, is to at least, you know, do some type of critique, you know. But like I say, I really don't mind when I see the blatant insults like what he did, because that's just saying, okay, you haven't got an argument, you know. And that's most of what you see on Twitter and what you see on YouTube.
Can I ask a couple of questions? One more question, really, yeah, about your, yeah, videos, and then I will be back in again. So obviously your videos have a very distinctive smile, which is also true, but they have a very distinctive style. You're in front of the camera. Cindy's usually in the background. You explain things very slowly and carefully. Is your style very deliberate, or is it just who you are as a person that reflects your personality, or is it some combination of the both ways of lent into to how you are? Because it's quite interesting, because I think it's a little bit different. I think they're great, but they're a little bit different to, let's say...
Dan Wilson.
Yes, very different to,
Dan Wilson,
Debunk the Funk stuff.
Yes.
Not that his necessarily default, not that he obviously reflects his personality in them as well, but yeah, I'm wondering how much of it is, this is who I am as a person, I'm a happy, happy person who... Again, how much of it is a style choice to, I guess, attract an audience, right? Because we're all trying to attract an audience here. Right? Let's not pretend we're not.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question, and it is just my personality. It's just how I am. So yeah, I couldn't do it. Say how Dr. Wilson does it, because that's I can't help. Like, it's funny, all these people saying, oh, she's got that fake smile, no one really smiles that often, but you guys, how often have I been? Yeah, and I'm like this all the time. It's just it doesn't mean I'm never sad, it doesn't mean I don't cry sometimes. I do, you know, I'm just a typical person like that, but it's my general disposition to be like this, and I just automatically smile. I don't even consciously do it. Like, I remember someone on Twitter actually said, because someone had made a comment, as they do, you shouldn't smile so much, and this person, he was really polite and he was kind of trying to be nice. He said, you know, I really enjoy your videos, Susan. They're very educational, but yeah, I've got to admit that I do agree with this person that, you know, I find the smiling is all like a bit artificial. And I said, well, actually, that is me. And if I tried not to smile, that would actually be artificial, because that is just me. I mean, with Cindy being in the video, and like Julie was in there before, that started with Julie when she basically just, goes back to the days with Dr. Campbell, and I was literally trying to record a video and she just, it was like she started it, so to speak, and look, it did get a good reaction. So I thought, okay, people like seeing her, and and unfortunately then, because when, you know, Julie actually died, I actually felt like for a while I almost thought, no, I'm going to stop it. I'm not going to do it anymore, because I just sort of felt like I didn't want to almost, you know, she'd become so much part of the video with me. I just didn't feel motivated to do any more videos, and I sort of had a bit of a time where I didn't really do any recording, because I just sort of felt like, no, it's Julie's, you know, and I still got her picture on the channel. I can't take her picture off the channel, because it was like, well, I started the channel with her and she should still be on the channel. So in some ways, when I was starting it with her, I was thinking, well, you know, dogs normally live, little dogs, you know, 12, 15 or something. I thought, well, by the time she dies of old age, I'm not going to be making videos anymore. And then, of course, she died at 3. So it was like for a while there, I thought, no, I'm just not going to do it anymore. It's just, you know, my dog's gone. I don't want to do any of this. So, but then
yeah, it's quite interesting, because
now we have Cindy.
So. Literally, obviously, listeners won't know this, but we can actually all see each other. So, Dr. Oliver knows what I look like, and she knows what Dr. Megden looked like, which is, yeah, very. Mm.
And for $1 million, I'm willing to reveal it.
I won't blame you.
I'll do it for $500,000.
Anyway. So where was I? Yeah. So what I was going to say is that we can see each other, and it actually helps us to, you know, communicate, and somebody can raise a hand if they're going to ask a question or whatever. But actually, in the background is Cindy right now, so of Dr. Oliver's video. No, I have to say that somebody who, you know, is very often, like, probably one of my biggest motivations for getting into the counter disinformation space was, to be honest, anger. And I kind of feel that my best work is whenever I'm angry and sarcastic and full of derision. So, completely different personality type to you, Susan.
I think I can be sarcastic occasionally.
But I do think that it's good, you know, for everybody to sort of be who they are on these things. So I think it's great that you and Dr. Wilson do completely different styles of things. And I think it's, you know, there's every chance that you two will end up doing very similar videos covering very similar things, but potentially appealing to a completely different audience. And that's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I think we do have, I mean, obviously Dr. Wilson has a lot more subscribers than me, but I think I know a lot of people who watch my channel also watch his channel. Yeah.
Well, I felt really sorry for, it's funny, I felt really sorry for Dr. Wilson whenever he did the RFK book. The last video he did about that, you could see the light drained from his eyes.
Yeah, because he did a 500-page thing. The worst I've done is a 40, so.
Yeah. The other person is a very different style, again, and very different videos. I think they're primarily TikToks. I don't even think they're primarily Twitter videos. That guy, you know, drew comments.
Oh, yeah, he was cool, yeah. I think he's still going, yeah.
I will get his Twitter handle. It is at SJS856. So that is SJS856, all one word. And he did a great video, the one that's actually pinned at the minute, Why Get Vaccinated When You Can Still Get COVID? And he responds to, I guess, an NBA athlete who, because it says NBA edition on his Twitter, on his tweet as well, he responded to an NBA player who made that comment with, well, why practice when you can still lose? And I thought, wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, I think it's time to get on to maybe one of our last topics. There's two left, so this one should be quick. So it's another sort of misinformation tactic. It's maybe not that common in science, but it's called the sharpshooter fallacy. So what it is, it's essentially comes from where, you know, someone who claims to be the best shooter in the world, he pulls out his gun and just fires a bunch of bullets. And then he said, you see, those bullets went perfectly where I was aiming, you see. And that's sort of like where it sort of comes from. So one of the ways is sort of like you can just find where there's a random cluster of data or something and find a justification to, you know, draw your target around it after. Or another sort of way of looking at it is there was a paper from Sweden from the 30s where they looked at like living near power lines, so kind of similar to the 5G sort of stuff, and like 1,000 different diseases. It just so turned out that there was a cluster around one for leukemia, but it wasn't actually true when they tried to confirm it later. So that's something to sort of look out for when, you know, you're comparing, you know, something to about 1,000 other things, that there'll be some weakness in the data where you'll be able to draw a cluster somewhere is basically what it is. And our final note I have is how can people find scientific papers for themselves? And sort of like, if you have a paper which appears to be making fantastical conclusions, how do you find what other authors in that space have said?
If we're talking about medical type stuff, yeah, just look it up on PubMed. Just look what the main subject areas of the paper is, and just put it into PubMed and see what comes up.
Yeah, or there's Google Scholar as well, but
yeah, Google Scholar as well. If it is medical, I'd use PubMed as opposed to Google Scholar, because Google Scholar will still pull up your predatory journals,
right?
Whereas PubMed won't show the predatory journals.
Because what I always like to do is, like, if someone, you know, just assess the state of literature is a really good thing to do. So just like pull up a bunch of abstracts from papers in the field and just look, you know, do they say anything similar? Because if like there's 50 papers which are radically different, and then there's one which says, you know, there's some sensationalist result, the skepticism should be on the one which says there's a sensationalist result, not the 50 others. So that's a common sort of tactic, you know, in misinformation. You know, there's one paper which is now retracted, which says vaccines might cause autism. And there's probably 300 with way better sample sizes, which say it doesn't, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing to do is, of course, is to see if there's actually been a meta-analysis done, as in a real one, not one on a dodgy website who pretends they do meta-analyses, but if there's actually published meta-analyses, like if Cochrane, if they've done a Cochrane review, that would be a really good place to start, would see has anyone done a Cochrane review on it, and that'll give you a good idea of what the state of the research is. So perhaps instead of just Googling or looking up on PubMed the area, is actually add the word meta-analysis to it and then see if there's anyone's actually done that.
Yeah, it is important to remember as well that Tess Laurie, you know, they would call it a Cochrane review when it wasn't, so it's still not perfect, so still be sceptical. But
yes, and that's why, well, if you actually want to see a Cochrane review, you go to the Cochrane website. So there is actually a website, yeah. So I think it was quite amusing that Tess Laurie claimed she was doing a Cochrane review, and then somehow Cochrane actually did their own review, which didn't look anything like the one that Tess Laurie did.
These are two questions that like have come up now due to some of the other stuff that you were talking about in the interview, and they're not exactly sciencey questions, but they're just more about you. We heard about your genesis story about why you started making videos and everything. And I love your video essay style. I think it's good. It's relaxed. You're friendly. You've got Cindy running around in the back. You're smiling. It's all good. I think it comes across very genuine. And you tend to do a lot of like reaction videos to recent dramas or bad information that's out. But if nothing happened for a month, like, what would your next video be? What would the video that you want to make be?
Oh, I don't know. There's so many. I've literally got a list of videos that I want to make, because I think I've been concentrating mainly on COVID misinformation, but there's heaps and heaps. Before COVID, there was heaps and heaps of cancer misinformation. There's also like diet information, like all this. I'm probably going to have hate mail from this, but I love carbohydrates, right? So I want, and look, I'm 57. You can only see the top half of me, but trust me, I'm not overweight. My blood works perfect. My blood pressure's perfect. I'm really healthy. I eat lots of carbs. I can't stand all these people pushing low-carb diets, and I would really love to do a video about why carbs are wonderful. And I'm hesitant to do it because I think I'm going to get even more hate mail or people insulting me than what I do for doing videos supporting vaccines. Because there are, like, if you just there are just so many people that say you should avoid carbs. And I'm not saying that if people don't want to eat carbs, don't eat carbs, but don't try and make them out to be monsters. If you're happy, if you can not eat carbs and lose weight, yeah, fine, do it. Keep checking your cholesterol. But really, this is whole thing about maligning carbs. I mean, carbs are wonderful. I do not feel satisfied if I don't have carbs in my meal. Every single meal, I've got to have carbs. I love them. And I'm talking generally healthy carbs. Like, I don't mean I sort of eat teaspoons of sugar or anything crazy like that. I have porridge for breakfast, and I have wholemeal bread and stuff like that. So I don't sort of eat a lot of refined carbs, but I just don't get all these people picking on carbohydrates. So I would love to do a video about that, and it's on my list of things to do, but I haven't got around it. And I suspect I think the problem is too, once you start a channel looking at certain things, your audience wants to see that sort of stuff. So if I did something on carbs, no one would probably watch it anyway. Like, I did one a little while ago on apple cider vinegar and whether it works for weight loss or not. And it got some views, but I think it's still under 1,000. So it's just sort of like, it's not the interest of the people watching my shows.
Yeah. When you're making content, sometimes you have to react to things that they want you to react to. You know, they want to hear your opinion on something that's going on.
It's a really relevant question to ask, because we started this out and we've done a lot of COVID stuff, and I assume that our audience expects COVID stuff. But we're also trying to branch this out a little bit. It's a really relevant answer to us as well.
And I'm trying to do that as well. So I'll do a COVID one, but then, so like the ones I'm doing on logical fallacies, the one I've just done, even though it's on logical fallacy, it does talk about COVID, but I'm going to do some that don't mention COVID at all, because I'm sure at some stage people are going to get sick of hearing about about COVID. But when I do our stuff, like I did one on monkeypox, I mean, some people watched it, but it didn't get the same views. As I think it's not so much that people in general aren't interested in it, it's just that YouTube probably serves my videos to people who are interested in a particular topic. But at the end of the day, I think you just accept that some of your videos are going to be popular, some of them aren't going to be popular. It doesn't really matter, as long as, you know. And they'll never have zero views because my friends will watch them, you know. So I'll at least manage to get about 10 views, you know.
Yeah. My second question, actually, it's come up a few times, but it came up in this answer again. I was kind of struck something you said earlier, and it's this common thing of like men regulating the smiles of women, like telling you you're smile too much, you're not smiling enough. My big question really, first, how do you feel about the trolling? And secondly, how do you deal with the trolling?
Okay, so I think I knew before I started the channel that I was going to get the trolling, because I'd already got it when I was making the videos on Dr. Campbell's channel. So even though I had a lot of really positive comments, there were also the insults, things like it was all about the way I looked, or some people just generally my irritating voice and the fact that I had an Australian accent, which is unfortunate. And and particularly because I don't know, do you guys know that I'm actually English?
No, we didn't.
So I was born, I don't know if you've ever heard of a town called Ashton-under-Lyne?
No.
It's a outer suburb of, did you call them suburbs in England, or do you call them towns? You call suburbs.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, so it's an outer suburb.
I get it. Why? Were you English but sent to Australia because you did a crime?
I'm not that old.
Wow, what a punishment.
Wow. So how do you feel about the trolling, Susan?
Oh, okay. I don't really mind the insults that much, because it's kind of like saying to me, you can't critique anything I've said. You've got to resort to insults. So in a way, to me, it's like, well, that person, you know, they've got nothing. They've had to use insults. So I just sort of think of it that way. The thing that bugs me most is people who haven't watched my videos and they come making comments that I've actually addressed in the video. That's what bugs me the most. It's like, if you're going to leave a nasty comment, at least watch the videos so that you're not actually making a comment that I've actually debunked in the video that you're making a comment on. So that actually bugs me more, because it's like, I bloody addressed that. How can you be asking that question? Whereas if they're just saying, oh, you've got a creepy smile. It's funny enough, in the video I've just recorded, so one person very nicely left a message saying that they love my necklace. And then someone else says, I think it's really gaudy. And it's like, why do you have to insult someone? It's like, you know, it's just, we used to have a saying when I was growing up, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. But people aren't like that, and that's life. And I think, if you are affected by stuff like that, you don't start a YouTube channel. I think the harder thing, though, and that's a decision you can make, and if it's going to bother you, you probably shouldn't do it. But the problem is, though, people also can suffer that type of stuff in a workplace or whatever, and then, of course, you can't say, well, go and find another job. you know, because it's quite different. So I think on social media, I know that I can handle it and it's no big deal. But I think the harder thing is because obviously I'm not the only woman who suffers this type of thing. And if it's not in this type of situation, but it's more just in an everyday situation, I think that's a lot tougher for someone because you can't remove yourself from that situation. Like I can decide tomorrow, okay, this has got too much, close down the channel. It's not really going to matter. But, you know, someone who suffers that type of stuff just every day, what do they do? How do they get away from it? You know, it's, I don't know what the answer is. People should be nicer, but they're not.
We talked about this particularly annoying thing where somebody will reply or will write a comment and the comment has revealed that they haven't watched the video. Do you ever reply to the comments? Because I imagine that those ones in particular are really, really tempting to reply to, if like just a timestamp or something.
Yeah, I do, yeah. Not always, and there's no rhyme or reason when I decide to and when I don't. It's usually what I'm doing when I see the comment. If I'm busy, I ignore it. If I'm not busy, sometimes I'll go and type something back. And then, of course, you'll get people complaining, how come you replied to that comment but you never replied to my comment? You obviously can't address what I'm saying. It's like, no, I just can't be bothered. You know, so because I know Dr. Wilson, I think he actually says in his video description that he doesn't read them. And I think once you get to a certain size, maybe people don't do them as often. But I know Dr. John Campbell, who had, you know, when I was on his channel, just under a million subscribers, he definitely, I don't know whether he read every single comment, but he used to say to me, oh, look, I've been reading the comments, you know, people really like you. So he obviously still read his comments. So I think a lot of people read their comments, and ever so often you used to see Dr. Campbell would actually reply to a comment. And I reply sometimes to people who say nice things and just say thank you, or you've got this little, you know, you give a little comment, a little heart if you like it. So I put lots of hearts on comments, which gets the trolls really upset. How come you are, this is one of the questions someone asked me, how come you only heart comments that say nice things about your video? It's like, what, you think I should be hearting the comments that are insulting me? Like, are you a moron? You know?
Yeah, and probably if you reply to that comment with, are you a moron, question mark, it probably wouldn't help you. That's something we always ask is, Dr. Oliver, have you anything to plug?
I have a YouTube channel called Back to the Science. If you go onto YouTube and actually just search for Back to the Science, my channel will now come up. When I first started my YouTube channel, it actually didn't come up. You used to get all these videos about back science and how to do exercises for your back. But now I'm actually coming up. So if you actually put in Back to the Science, it will actually come up with my YouTube channel. And also if you actually just put in Dr. Susan Oliver, you'll also find my YouTube channel. And we'd love to see you there.
Well done. And there'll be a link in the notes.
Oh, yes, and there'll be a link in the show notes.
Susan, thank you very much. It was great to have you as a guest, and thank you very much for answering our questions. And we hope that you enjoyed speaking to us as much as we enjoyed speaking to you.
I certainly did. Thank you, lads, and I'll see you on tour.
Bye.
Bye.